I'm going to start with a quote from a famous social critic that I think will be very familiar to all of you here. "We have met the enemy, and he is us." Pogo. I decided that Pogo is a psychoanalyst. His observation rings true for a number of reasons and in a number of ways. We are often our own worst enemies. We often act self-destructively. Our biggest enemy is our own destructiveness. And as Dr. Price was just saying, we need to find an enemy in order to project, get rid of unwanted parts of ourselves, and throw them out of ourselves into somebody else who we can then attack for being really bad. We're then justified in hating our enemy, trying to control the enemy, even to destroy him. Enemies are really useful. They keep us the good guys. If we lose one, we can always find another. They may even cooperate by hating us back and acting really, really bad. In fact, they may start it in the first place, provoking our hatred. They may act stupid or they may do nothing at all except be quite different from us. I know an adolescent who's convinced that everyone at her school hates her, looks down on her, and thinks bad thoughts about her. They're the enemy. She's projecting her own self-hatred. If she were really paranoid, she might go further and provoke the enemy. She could get angry. She could say, "Why are you looking at me?" Then they would really look at her funny, just like she suspected. It's not unusual for an adolescent confrontation or even a violent eruption to occur because the other guy looked at me funny or dissed me. The final way of looking at Pogo's very erudite statement is that if we do manage to see our enemy as just another human being like ourselves, their enemy-ness dissolves. According to modern psychoanalytic theory, our biggest psychic problem is what we do with our aggression, our wish to destroy and dominate. Finding an enemy is very useful in this process. I remember my first encounter with this whole idea. I was riding to school with a fellow student, and she told me quite gleefully that she found another hate object. I'd never heard this word before, but she told me all about a woman she felt very envious of and competitive with, and she was very happy to tell me about everything that was wrong with her. Though I hadn't thought about having a hate object before, I immediately recognized its utility. Sigmund Freud studied and wrote a great deal about the individual, as we all know, but he also wrote about society and social processes. He was a social theorist. He noted in one of my favorite works, Group Psychology and the Analysis of the Ego, that groups show evidence of a readiness for hatred and aggressiveness, the source of which is unknown. A year later, he would postulate the source as the death drive, the urge to return to a tensionless, inorganic state, which, under the influence of the life drive, was turned outward as aggression. The idea of a death drive is very controversial. It's the idea that we're innately prone to be destructive and aggressive. Most of us would rather think that our destructive urges and hateful feelings are due to frustrations and deprivation, slights and torments that we've experienced. In a perfect world, we'd be absolutely fine. So the driver who cuts you off in traffic, the boss who criticizes, the parent who didn't understand, or even outright neglected, they are responsible. However, if you accept the idea of innate aggression, the problem isn't just in preventing deprivation and frustration. The problem is in finding a reasonable and constructive outlet for our aggressive urges. The young child takes pleasure in destructive acts until trained to give up this behavior for the somewhat lesser pleasure of pleasing the parent. The adult, too, takes pleasure in destructive fantasies. Violence is pleasurable. I don't want to minimize the effects of abuse and deprivation. A childhood environment of violence and deprivation can lead to a personality organized around hatred and increase the propensity to violent acts, but this is not inevitable. So, what does drive theory, as Freud formulated it, have to do with group psychology, social psychology, and power? In discussing group psychology, Freud noted that the individual gives up his own superego or moral sense, his own judgment when he merges with the group, taking on the group ego ideal or standards and experiencing the power of the group as invincible. Many of you in this room, I assume, have at some point experienced the thrill of being part of a huge demonstration and just the sheer force of 10,000, 100,000, even a million people is intoxicating. You feel like you're part of a very powerful force. However, the group may be prone to destructive action, particularly a group without a task or without a leader. Emotions and actions are highly contagious, and a group can easily turn into a mob. This kind of process has been documented. Just think about what happened after the Super Bowl. Even though everyone was ecstatic that their team had won, the violence erupted, cars were overturned. A presumably satisfied but very aroused crowd turned into a destructive mob. Groups do seek leaders, and the group will invest and seek a leader who manifests qualities of themselves that are exaggerated. We can certainly see this in any political campaign. A regular guy, down to earth, not too intellectual, someone who looks like us. A leader may help direct the group into constructive action and activity and strengthen ties between members. If a group is structured and task-oriented, there's a greater tendency for constructive behavior, though the loss of structure, the loss of a leader, or the loss of a task may quickly lead to regression into restlessness, loss of inhibitions, increase in impulsive action. In studies of unstructured groups, two types of groups and leadership seem to evolve to manage the tension and chaos of the group. The dependent group, which depends on a leader for security and supplies, looking to the leader to provide structure and help the group have a feeling that everything is all right. It's been observed that often the leader in this kind of group holds the group together with somewhat superficial ideas and banalities, but nevertheless holds the group together. And there's a tendency to idealize the leader and give the group then a sense of omnipotence through identifying with the omnipotence they've given to the leader. The second type of group is the paranoid group, tense and oriented to danger, likely to split into subgroups which are hostile to each other, insiders versus outsiders, and seeking a paranoid leader who will identify an outside enemy and direct the aggression outward from the group. The paranoid leader seeks to be feared, not loved, and maintains absolute control. The group, in other words, seeks a leader who will help them to manage their anxiety. The most terrifying anxiety is the anxiety of annihilation. This could be experienced as fear of the group disintegrating, fear of the self disintegrating, or even just sensing the group's latent destructive impulses. Psychoanalysts understand that the sense of helplessness in the face of potential annihilation is overwhelming. Consequently, a variety of defenses are used to help manage the anxiety that results from this fear. We saw this in post-September 11th. Many people reported feeling extremely anxious, feeling like society, the world as they knew it, was disintegrating, unable to really manage their anxiety, at least initially. And a number of defenses were employed. One very commonly used one is denial, the idea that, well, nothing bad is really going to happen, annihilation won't really happen, nuclear weapons will never be used, nobody would be that crazy, as a way to try to handle the anxiety. Another common defense is apathy. Can't do anything anyway, so why bother? And then a common defense is what we call the splitting defense, which I've already described by talking about the enemy. Fighting a bad guy, then feeling that we ourselves are good. If the bad is out there, we can all get organized around identifying the bad, attacking the bad, maybe even taking action against the bad, and reassuring ourselves of our own goodness and invulnerability. In paranoid extremes, one's own group is superhuman, chosen, superior, and the enemy other is dehumanized, evil, and even compared to vermin or disease. The establishment of empire, then, would be a concrete reassurance of one's group's or nation's omnipotence and power and invulnerability to destruction. As long as the power to annihilate exists, which of course it now does, such reassurance is false and dangerously misguided. In the analyses of the post-September world, this cycle of helplessness, terror, and omnipotence, or seeking the illusion of being all-powerful, and splitting, was clearly in place and is still in place. And the need to hold on to and maintain the illusion of omnipotence through exercising the superior power to destroy prevents an examination of the complexity of intergroup, internation relations, and is a clear manifestation of the underlying wish to dominate rather than coexist. In his later writings, Freud examined the nature of society and civilization and the role of the state in taking the right to use violence unto itself exclusively in order to enforce the moral code. Freud was very skeptical of the state, seeing it as a necessary evil, and aware of the possibility of the state subverting its role in maintaining the social order under the influence of what he said was the death drive. In other words, exploiting power and looking to dominate rather than mediate and encourage cooperation. In his letters to Einstein, which have been published under the title Why War, he expresses his skepticism regarding man's ultimate ability to manage his impulses and prevent his own destruction, as technology makes weapons of destruction more and more lethal. He saw hope in two possibilities. One was education, educating everyone so that we could turn to reason instead of violence, and noted that the process of civilization should lead to an abhorrence for war. The other thing he thought of as a possibility was to increase global identification. If we could just increase our ties to each other and see everyone as like ourselves, forming one global group with a superordinate decision-making body such as the League of Nations is what he was writing about in his time. We see where that's gone recently. Then he felt there would be hope to really prevent war. A group needs binding, something to pull it together and add structure, and oriented toward constructive aims. A leader serves this function, as does an ideology. However, an ideology can be dangerous if it takes the place of thought. Christopher Bolas, a prominent psychoanalyst, wrote a book on character in which he described what he called the fascist state of mind, the mind that gives itself over to an ideology which brooks no opposition, which cannot tolerate complexity and contradiction and doubt, and essentially gives up the need to think and decide or make moral choices. Such a state of mind is a precursor to destructive action, such as genocide. When an ideology explains all, there's no doubt or opposition. The self or one's group or state is idealized, grandiose, and intolerant of any difference or opposition to itself. The self is emptied, words are empty, mere slogans, and unwanted doubts are experienced as contaminants which need to be projected into a victim. Such a state of mind, Bolas argues, is in each of us in some everyday manifestations, which we can clearly see in any political campaign, for example, in which denigration, caricaturing, character assassination, taking words out of context go on, and a whole group may be stereotyped and labeled as a way of dismissing them. Why is ideology powerful? It provides a simplifying world, defines good and bad, and prescribes action. It also provides unity of purpose with a group and leader, and gives a group a sense of purpose. It reduces anxiety, ambiguity, and choice, and in some cases, it justifies violence. In an article reported in the New Yorker several years ago, an ex-neo-Nazi named Ingo Hasselbach wrote of his experience being in the neo-Nazi movement in East Germany and then coming out of it. This is what he wrote when he first saw a Nazi film. Music was stirring, as vast as the concepts newsreels reinforced. Camaraderie, patriotism, dreams of conquest. It was cool to watch weapons being used and fascinating to see a time when German men had been on the move. It was the opposite of the stagnant national pool we'd grown up in under East German communism. Hasselbeck describes a life in the movement organized around violence and an ideology of hate. He was able to leave because a reporter came to do a story on him. This led to him beginning to question his own ideology as he was espousing it to this reporter. After he left, he says, "The splendid diversity of the world was brought home to me in a way it had never been before. It was as though I'd stepped out of a cartoon universe into real life and was seeing it before me in its staggering complexity. Where before I'd seen everything in terms of certainties, now I saw it as an endless string of questions." Hasselbach's world had been one of violence and